This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So I have my co-host Aaron Brabham here with me today. Hey, Aaron, how you doing?
Doing well, James. I know people are used to hearing me on the Ask Altucher Daily podcast. If you're not used to hearing my voice, then you don't listen to the Ask Altucher shows, and you really, really should.
Those are fun. We have a fun time on those.
We have a great time on those.
And, you know, notice I didn't do a whole big intro on this one, because here's what I figure about intros now. People are already clicking on the podcast. They know it's the James Altucher mm-hmm. show. Why? And I'm always so stupid. Like, I always say, this is James Altucher, the James Altucher show. Everybody knows that already.
Plus, you have bumper. By the way, plus you have bumper music that intros you in as the James Altucher show.
Oh my God! It's going to be so much better not to have my annoying voice say my name five times in a row.
But that's not why you invited me on today, James. Why did you invite me on to for this show? It's going to be a unique one.
Okay, there's a couple reasons. One is I interviewed Biz Markie, the rapper. You know who he is, right?
Of course. Baby, you got what I need.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. He's awesome.
One of my all-time
iconic
favorite rap
yes.
songs. So for whatever reason, I was obsessed with interviewing him. And I'll get to that in a second. But I interviewed him on the podcast, and it was the worst interview any podcaster ever did with anybody. And it's not his fault. It was completely my fault. So I kind of wanted to go over it and analyze it a little bit more in depth and give him more credit than I was able to in the interview, but also kind of explain more some of the things he's talking about, because I didn't really give him a chance in the interview. It's fascinating what I learned from him in the interview. So I just didn't want to miss that opportunity. So what we're going to do is we're going to replay the interview and pause and stop at different points and kind of talk about what he's saying a little bit more. But I want to say also, a lot of times people say, how do you get all these people on your podcast? Like, is it only because of your network? And I have to say, I did not know Biz Markie at all. What I did was I kind of put the word out. And then literally a guy who works for a company that I know, his lawyer's son is some kind of music agent. And he was nice enough to call Biz Markie's management company. And then they didn't return any of my calls for a while. They did after a while. And finally, it was like 20 calls later, we narrowed it down and Biz Markie was going to call in. And it took months to line up that interview. So it was to line up a lot of these podcast interviews is really hard work. And we still didn't even know 1 minute before he was going to call in that he was going to call in. So that's lesson number one there on podcasting. It had nothing to do with Biz Markie. He's a busy guy.
Yeah, I get that. You know, but I'm going to sit here and be kind of like a not devil's advocate, but I'm going to challenge you during this interview process. You know, I've been podcasting for, I don't know, close to 3 years now. I've done live radio for a couple of years in Orlando. And sometimes I think interviews are really terrible, but then from an outside perspective, they're not so bad. So I'm interested to see why you're so critical of this one. I know you wrote a post about it and you did say that, you know, he was like a idol to you. You know, you considered him a quote unquote friend. But you didn't feel like he was being a friend to you. So I'm curious to see the psychology behind that, because maybe you were just giddy, like a crush on him.
Intimidated, and maybe I just wanted to be like best friends with him afterwards. You know, like Biz Markie and I would start hanging out afterwards.
Kind of like what you did with Ice-T. You became
exactly.
Ice-T's man, like that. You know, that's what you kind of wanted.
Well, I went on Ice-T's podcast and he's going to come on this podcast too. So he'll be on in a couple of weeks. And he was a really great guy, very, you know, very engaging. And we had a lot to talk about. I think Biz is a little bit more, he's very focused on what he does, but he's built a great career. You know, we'll get to it in the interview. Let's start it off. And Tim Shulka, you're in the house here, right? So we're gonna tell you to start and stop every now and then, okay?
All right, sounds good.
Okay, so let's start the Biz Markie interview. This is James Altucher with the James Altucher Show, and I can't believe I'm actually talking to this guest, Biz Markie. Okay. Welcome to the show.
So we can. What's up, son? What's up?
So I want to stop for a second. I'm like yelling to the audience here. Like, Aaron, do I do this on every single
Man, is it going to be one of these where we stop like every five words, James? Are you going to get so neurotic about this? Maybe this is a terrible idea for us to go through this thing.
I am neurotic. I don't want to say I'm a
perfectionist. You're on your way to being one, but you're more of a laid back perfectionist. You understand you have flaws. There's a big difference.
Yeah. Like in anything, like in chess, for instance, whenever you lose a game, that's the best opportunity to learn because you analyze your mistakes. So I think it's really like I am never, ever for the rest of my life going to yell an intro on
a
podcast.
You know what? You're excited. You're showing your passion. But OK, fine. I don't see any problem with it at all. So I'll say we just continue forward.
OK, continue forward. I'm so excited you're here. You're really... Like we're close to the same age, but to me you're a hero. You're like a legend, the father of hip hop, pretty much.
Oh,
and I
thank
just
you. I'm not the father, but I'm one of the uncles.
He's the uncle of hip hop.
The uncle of hip hop. I'm gonna call you that.
So I just really wanted to talk to you, find out how it all started, find out what's been going on since then, and what you're up to now. Because what's impressed me with you is that you were so pivotal at the beginning of the hip hop industry, and your career, you've reinvented your career in so many ways. I kind of want to just talk about that because so many of our listeners are also reinventing their careers. And even though it might be different than how you did, I think they can get a lot of inspiration from how you did it. So, what happened in the beginning? How did it all start out? What got you interested in what you did?
Okay, in 1977 or 78, I heard a tape from the L Brothers from my man Derek Mangaroo. And ever since I heard it was Grandma's Theater and the L Brothers, and that's what got me hooked on hip-hop. And the reason that I tried so hard to get into hip-hop is because I always used to try to get into a group and they would never let me in.
What would they say? I mean, obviously you had talent. What would they say?
I mean, at the beginning days, I guess I wasn't as good as everybody, you know. I had to work to get good.
When you were working to get good, how many hours a day were you practicing? Were you going to high school at the time, or what was going on?
Well, I was in junior high, and then I went to high school, and then I used to practice at least about 16 hours to 10 hours a day, because I was doing the beatbox. So
okay, stop.
I used to try to make
6 to 10 hours a day of practice.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's somebody who really wants it. So a lot of the questions that we get on Ask Altucher are from people that won't do any work until they're given a guarantee on the back end. But as you know, James, there are no guarantees in life, and you need to do the work first. This is a guy who was he was damn determined to become good.
Yeah, like so many people say, like, oh, I have a full-time job, but I have an idea. How can I raise venture capital so I can leave my job? And look, I appreciate that. They probably have an idea that they're passionate about, but this is 6 to 10 hours a day of practice, and that's how you get to be not the father of hip-hop, but just the uncle.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, okay, so let's get going.
Mimic records and do different sounds that's funky.
So just for, I don't know if you want to do this, but just for the listeners who don't even know what beatbox is, do you want to describe what that is, or do you want to give an example?
Okay, beatboxing is music done orally. Like if I went. That's what the human beatbox is.
You still got the skills.
Oh, yeah. I can't lose. It's just like riding the bike.
Huh. So 6 to 10 hours a day of hard work. This is – I don't think people realize what really goes into the making of an artist. It wasn't like you suddenly came up with a hit song and we're out there. This was – you know, the song you're most well-known for came out in 1989 or 1988, but you were from 1977
on,
working 6 to 10 hours a day.
I had hit records before that.
Right, so you had albums.
Okay,
you had several albums.
You were
Okay, so he's really only known for Just a Friend, but you know, I think I wasn't giving enough respect to the fact that he really did have a bigger career than just that one song. Like, it's just that that's, you know, let's say one of the, that's the song that's kind of lasted through time.
Yeah, you know, okay, so here's my observations just so far in the podcast from a podcaster, right?
Okay.
All right, so you definitely started off the interview as giddy, like a little school kid, right? Like, this is your idol and your hero, which is not bad because you want to give good positive energy to start off an interview. I always believe in that. Come in hot, right? I thought that you definitely put him up on a pedestal early on, but you didn't do what James Altucher usually does, which is give very specific examples of you doing research on him. It's almost like you started this podcast off as if you're a fan, but you don't really know his work very well. So he's posturing a little bit. I see what he's doing now because I don't think he realizes that you know his biography in and out at this point yet. So I can see him taking a little defensive
here. But the reality is, His hits before were not really like top 10 hits. Like they were hits in Queens, for instance, but they weren't like national hits, which I appreciate. Like, he was like an underground guy, and he came up from that. But the first one that was like a Billboard top 100 was Just a Friend. And that was almost really the last one. But that said, he's absolutely correct. Like, he was well known in New York, where I grew up, as like a great rapper before that hit. But, you know, so he's correct. He's schooling me.
Well, yeah, he is. And you know, some artists, they really become bitter about like their big hits, right? Because that's where most people know them, and that's where they got a lot of wealth and fame and fortune. But then they end up resenting it. I remember John Bon Jovi said it best. He goes, "Look, when I have a concert, I'm going to play my biggest hits because that's what the fans love, and I want to give them that experience." But, you know, artists are notorious for this. Prince got into this really bad habit of saying, "Look, if you bought your ticket," and he would say this at concerts, "if you bought your ticket expecting to hear Purple Rain, you might as well get up and leave right now because I'm probably going to play not a single song that you know."
Well, it actually then reminds me of the Seinfeld quote, like, you know, when Howard Stern asks him, you know, "Why'd you go out at the top? Everybody wanted another season." And Jerry Seinfeld said, "Howard, that's why I went out, because I'm in show business, not the public is not in show business. If they were, they'd be doing the show. So I'm in show business, and that's why I went out at the top."
That's a good point. By the way, his beatbox, I think he's the world's best, and I don't think anybody could even argue against that. And for anybody that's not really familiar with Biz, it was Men in Black, I think, number 3, where he's a worker and he starts to do the beatbox. And it's
he's an alien.
Yeah, he's
right?
An alien.
Or no,
yes.
he worked for them.
Yes, he was an alien. And then he starts to, like, it's kind of like unlocking the code where he shows. But, I mean, the guy is a freaking mad genius. So, all right.
Yeah. And also, by the way, if you like Just a Friend and want to hear him more doing beatbox, I think even a better song is search on YouTube, DJ Kool, "Let Me Clear My Throat,"
yes,
with Biz Markie, because he makes a guest appearance and he does beatbox, and it's a great song. It's a fun song to just listen to.
And everybody will know "Let Me Clear My Throat" because it's still played today, even especially at weddings and crazy things like that.
And I think when in the standard song, Biz is not there, but in the YouTube version, he makes a guest appearance. They're at a club, and I think his part is like the best part in the song.
I'm definitely going to listen to it. All right, so at this point, James, did you start to feel a little bit of like tension, like, "Uh-oh, I got schooled a little bit," or you're still like, "I don't really care, man. Just
no, no, I felt like I was getting schooled because I didn't want to insult him by saying, you know, he did have
that,
like,
saying you're a one hit wonder.
Yeah, like I didn't want to get so fast into the one hit wonder aspect, but okay, there we are.
Right.
Okay, let's
roll.
Let's keep going. Pretty well known, but from 1977 on,
like when Just a Friend came out, that was my second album. My first album is what I was known for with Nobody Beats the Biz, Pickin' Boogies, Vapors, There's Something for the Radio, Make the Music. You know what I mean?
Why did you decide to go on your own? Were you not getting into any groups, or were you in a group?
I was in a group called Midnight Express back in the day. But besides that, I wanted to be a soloist because I wanted to be like a one-man band.
And okay, stop, so when stop your there. First album came out, So I just want to point out, it's really hard to be a one man in a band. I mean, in a band with like a bunch of people.
Yeah, it's called EDM music, and being a DJ is your only chance.
Yeah, so Bismarcky is a great example of a guy who like chose himself. He's like, as far as I know, he's like the first rapper really who chose himself, who was just doing it by himself. I mean, I guess Ice-T, but Ice-T had a band, like he had a metal band around him.
Yeah, absolutely. So. Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
All right, we'll go ahead. Oh, and it was starting to be a hit. Did your life change? Because hip-hop it was already big, but it wasn't as big as it later became. Like, how did your life change?
Well, my life just changed financially, but otherwise my life was still the same. You know, I always had friends and stuff like that.
Right, so, but you were working, even though you were a soloist, you were working with a lot of guys like Dougie Fresh, DJ Kool. You were working with your core group of people.
Well, me and Dougie always been boys. You know, we were the first ones to do the beatbox, and Buffy from the Fat Boys. But I knew DJ Kool from something else, so that all of them came after I was making records. Like, I did DJ Kool in 90-something.
Okay, because I remember you from the part in "Let Me Clear My Throat." But
there you go.
Yeah, but
DJ
that
Kool
was in 90 something. That was
okay.
I
stop
making records.
I'm gonna call stop on this one. Okay, so he now has it. I'm just guessing. He now has it in his mind that you don't know anything about the history of his music, because now he's
like
even battling with like 90.
Talking about
yeah.
every one of his friends.
But he's even pointing out like, well, Kool was after, you know, me and Dougie Fresh are way before then. And that song was way. I mean, he's we're talking a couple of years, and we're talking 20 years ago almost. Right. But
yeah,
he's stuck in this like. In his mind, quit talking about my damn one hit wonder. That's what I feel like he's doing.
Yeah. And I'm, what was interesting to me though, there was, you know, I don't know if they're still doing stuff together, but I always find it fascinating when all these guys started out as like junior high school kids, mm-hmm. just practicing together. Like, I think he and Dougie Fresh might've even gone to like junior high school together. And they sort of grew up in this industry and became famous together. And it's interesting to me, like, no man is an island. Like, there's no such thing as like just Albert Einstein working by himself in a patent office anymore. Like, now you have to kind of like bounce things off your friends, and creativity happens in groups and working together and with people you're having fun with, like he and Dougie Fresh, and then later DJ Kool. And then later, the Beastie Boys, you know, Bismarcky got a lot of benefit out of working with other people.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's roll.
Like in 90 or 89, so I wasn't really thinking about making records.
And why'd you stop making records?
I was just branding myself. Huh?
Why did you stop making records?
It got boring to me.
You just wanted to perform?
It got boring to me, and I just wanted to, teach myself how to DJ and teach myself how to do other things.
So you were achieving this success. I feel like you were at your peak. You were really breaking out, more than breaking out. You were like the best rapper around. And at that very point, you decided to stop making records. I'm just curious. Do you think you were almost afraid of what was going on, or
never afraid of what was going on? I just wanted to go on and move to do different things. Never afraid of no music.
Good.
That'll make sense.
So what did you do next? First off, let's go back. 1977 through the 80s, you're getting better. You started to be a soloist. Your albums come out. Financially, your life's improving.
My first record came out with Ross and Chante called The Death Fresh Girls in 84, 85. My first solo record came out was Make the Music in the Biz Band. That came out in 86. Then I was making singles and singles and singles, and then my first album came out in 88. That was the Business Going Off album. And then after that, in 89, I made the Just a Friend album.
And then after Just a Friend, everybody recognized you on the street. Like, everybody knew who you were.
They knew me before the Just a Friend. Instead of just United States.
Went global. You could sing Just a Friend. I can go to like...
You're not letting it go.
You know, China right now, and sing Just a Friend, and they'll know exactly... the words to the song. Like, it's totally, it's the most global song in the world.
But, you know, it's one of them records.
Yeah, it was a great record. So what did you do? What did you do after that? That must have just changed your life in terms of other artists must have wanted to work with you. Other artists must have wanted you to, like, DJ or produce their songs.
At the time, I was just having fun. And then after that, I started working with the Beatsy Boys. So we started to be bonding as a family. And then we started working on records together.
Like, you did a lot of songs with them. You did like Check Your Head, Ill Communication.
Yeah, I did like two or three of their albums with them.
How did you meet them?
We knew each other from New York, but we really bonded. There was in L.A., and we were playing a basketball game with me and the Booyah Tribe, me and the Beastie Boys versus the Booyah Tribe. And then after everybody, I just hung around. And then people started playing the piano, and I just started singing along. And then they just started laughing all night, and then we just bonded at court.
Because stop right there. Unlike a lot of... So I thought that was interesting, and I didn't really pursue it. But again, it's just like these random, you know... And Aaron, actually, we were talking about this a little before the podcast started. It's like when you're in a city or when you're in a scene, sometimes it's just these random interactions that inspire creativity. Like he did three albums with the Beastie Boys or four albums with the Beastie Boys.
Yeah, I didn't know that at all.
Just from a basketball game they met.
Yeah, and I mean, how huge were the Beastie Boys were way bigger than he ever was ever.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably, I don't know for sure, but I bet you know, he made more money working on their albums than he did on his own album.
I would bet you're right.
Although now, you know, I just heard just a friend, I was in a store with my kids the other day, and it was like, I think it was Forever 21, like some kind of little girl's clothing store. And I heard somebody sampling Just a Friend, and I asked my 12-year-old, like, who's that? And she said, oh, it's Austin Mahone. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I talked to the guy who is the sample. And she was like, really? But it's Austin Mahone. And so what's funny is I had taken my 12-year-old also to see Austin Mahone in concert, but that's another story.
So
his song, the point is Biz Markie's song, Just a Friend, is still played and none of his other songs are still played.
So when you heard it, when you're with your daughter, did you have a traumatic flashback to this interview?
I did.
I knew it.
And I was thinking to myself, boy, I can't wait to do that podcast with Aaron talking about
it. Okay. All right. Let's keep this thing rolling. I'm enjoying it. I see it going pretty well. Every time that he puts up a fence, you bring up a little, like a nuance, like a little, a point to show that you do have the knowledge, and he is participating pretty well. I mean, he kind of fought back a little bit, but he's still going with it. I'm enjoying it. I think it's a good interview so far.
Okay, good. I appreciate that. Let's keep going then. Of rappers, I feel you always added a lot of humor to your work. And I feel like the Beastie Boys did the same thing, even though they came at it from a different direction. And it seems like in the 90s, there became like the whole gangster rap element, which totally changed everything in the hip hop industry. And you weren't really a part of that.
I'm never going to be a part of that. I'm not a gangster.
Right. And that seemed like that took control of the industry, really. You know, you had guys like, you know, Puffy doing huge deals with record labels at that point and, you know, kind of leaving the old school rap behind.
Well, it wasn't a thing about leaving the old school rap. And I just came into my own and bonded myself as Biz. More like a character, more like a hip-hop ambassador.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you were in so many things. You were in Men in Black doing beatboxing. You were in Living Color. So you've kind of expanded all over the place. Like, how do you keep finding all these different opportunities? Do they come to you or do you go to them?
God blesses me and I'm just blessed by God.
Well, and so with the Beastie Boys,
I had to figure out how to keep going.
Right. And did you continue working with them through the 2000s or is it mostly in the 90s?
I mean, whenever we see each other, cause you know, both of us have busy schedules.
Right. So
whenever we see each other, we get together and we've been having fun.
So at any point during this, did you ever feel like you made a mistake? Like you should have kept doing solo albums, or do you should have kept doing X or Y, or, you know, was there ever a point that you had any regrets?
No, never no regrets, because if I want to make an album, I'll make an album.
Right. So, and then also, you started getting more into kind of, you know, acting, like being in Men in Black and things like that. And Just a Friend also must be licensed all over the place.
Here we go again with your Just a Friend.
Yeah, well, you know, I own Just a Friend, so, you know, they got a license to me. Hello.
Right. And so what, essentially, how did you start getting learning? How did you go from being at the top of the rap game to being a DJ? What did you have to do to start learning that? What did you have to do to start learning to be a DJ? You're at the top of the rap game, and now you want to switch basically to being a DJ. What did you have to do?
Well, I just had to practice. That's all. I was always a record collector, so I just had to practice.
And what was practicing like? Like just kind of trying different beats and trying different things?
Yeah, just practicing doing parties. That's all I had to do.
So fast forwarding to 2008, Chris Rock. How did you meet him?
I knew Chris Rock from back in early 80s, hanging around Brooklyn and everything. And, you know, me and Chris Rock has always been boys. We always make sure we call each other or keep in touch with each other. We always been boys. And then, you know, when he went on tour, I opened up for his tour or any TV shows, any records, I always did.
That's great, because he obviously has toured all over the place. Did you? I know you went. You went in 2008 touring with him, and again, you bring a lot of humor into the rap, which was perfect for Chris Rock's tour. So, would you tour with him again?
Oh yes. He's talking about touring again anyway. Yeah.
Okay, and then you wouldn't just do your own songs. You would essentially DJ the opening. Like you would take lots of songs and bring them into the Chris Rock open.
Yeah, I mean whatever it takes, I'll do it.
Okay, now out of left field, SpongeBob SquarePants. How did you get involved with them?
Well, I got a kid show called Yo Gabba Gabba, and the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants was at the show, and he said that he wanted me to be on the SpongeBob SquarePants.
And you were Kenny the Cat?
Yes.
Was that fun? Did people ever say, hey, that's Kenny? Did little kids ever say, hey, that's Kenny the Cat?
Oh, yeah. They know me as Biz B to the death. They know me from the Yo Gabba Gabba doing Biz B to the death.
Okay, good. So, another thing, I mean, it's amazing to me how many things you've done. You've really had a fun life. So you were in the first season of Celebrity Fit Club. What was that like? How'd you get involved in that?
My manager, they called for me, and my manager suggested I do it. So I wasn't going to do it.
And then you won. Like you lost more weight than anyone else.
Yeah, and I did. Yeah, and I just lost 150 pounds.
You lost 150 pounds. How much do you weigh?
Two something.
How'd you lose so much weight?
Diet and I just took a lot of sugar out of my, since I'm a diabetic, I took a lot of sugar out of my diet. And I'm drinking a soda called Zevia because it's from the stevia plant.
How do you spell that?
I'm a spokesperson for this new soda called Zevia. Z-E-V-I-A. If you want to Google it, you can Google ZEVIA/BizMarquee, and you'll see that I'm a spokesperson. But it's a good soda, tastes good, and it's just incredible. It's selling like a Whole Foods and Trader Joe's and all that.
Oh, I'm definitely gonna check that out. So how else did you lose weight? Like, what kind of diet did you go? Are you into things like the paleo diet or anything like that?
No, I made up my own diet. I was on Celebrity Fit Club, so I know what to do. I just did the thing. I drank more water and took in less intake of food.
So more water, less food.
Yeah.
And how long did it take to lose 150 pounds?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I'm gonna have to recommend this diet to people. So it's
just that GS got cut a lot of things out of your diet.
Now, back in the '80s when hip hop, like in
I didn't know where to go.
Hold on, stop,
Tim. I love your recovery, James, because he is making it difficult. I'm going to have to recommend this diet to a lot of my friends. Okay.
Just so here's the water.
Hey guys,
don't eat a lot of food.
Yeah. Hey guys, here's the Bismarcky diet. It's revolutionary. You ready? Drink a lot of water. Don't eat a lot of food. Come again. Yeah. It's his own diet. He just told me his secret. He lost 150 pounds. Amazing.
He lost 33% of his body weight.
It's amazing. Like, it's amazing. 150 pounds is an incredible feat for just. You know what that is? That
he lost me. Like, I'm 150 pounds.
Lost me plus 10. What I like is he doesn't care about that. Like, it doesn't faze him, right? It's not an accomplishment for him. He's you can tell what his mind is like. He's the type of guy that when he puts his mind to it, he just does it. He doesn't look for a bunch of excuses. He doesn't look for a bunch of tricks and gimmicks. He didn't go hire some nutritionist or anything like that. He just said, oh, it's a calorie in, calorie out game, and water will fill you up and water will flush you out. And that's all he did. And I think that Biz could be good at anything he set his mind to because he has that attitude of just doing. Would you agree with that?
I think that's right. You know, the funny thing is talking to him reminds me of like we did a podcast once here with Dan Marino, who's like the best football player ever or whatever. And it reminds me of talking to him like somebody whose brain is just geared to be he's not going to be like the best at everything in the world. But what he decides to be the best at, it's like a single-minded focus. That's what he's going to be good at. And you kind of just feel like that's what he can talk about.
Yes. Yes. All right. Let's continue.
You know, not nobody, but like kind of the world itself didn't know what hip hop was. I mean, it seemed like it was a very small audience. Did you guys have a sense that this was going to be much bigger?
I had a sense it was going to be much bigger. That's why I put my all and kept in doing hip hop.
Why did you have a sense it was going to be much bigger? Because everyone wants to know what's going to be the next big thing.
It was so musical. It was so different. It was so musical, and it needed a change in music.
And so, like, with
by the way,
like,
to just stop for a second. Notice these huge silences, like. He wasn't really giving me much. That's the problem with the interview.
Right. Like a lot of times when I have a guest on, it's my fault really. Like somehow we didn't bond. And a lot of times with my guests, we have more of a conversation and it's more fluid. Like I kind of got the feeling I wasn't doing a good job and he just kind of wanted to get off, you know, the podcast at that point.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say that it's your fault at all. Maybe he just doesn't like to do podcasts or interviews. Maybe he just doesn't like to do interviews, period.
Yeah, because I really had to beg to get him. Like, I must have made 20 calls with his manager.
And from, you know, I'm trying to think of this from a podcasting perspective, like a hosting role. I think there's nothing that you could do better at this point than what you've done because you've done a lot of cold reading. Which is a great technique to build rapport for those out there that don't know what it is. It's basically what palm readers use and tarot card readers and stuff like that. Essentially, it's a great way to bond, right? You're running like a rainbow of emotions by you're trying to let him know that you understand his world. You understand the hard work he's put in. You're trying to do that. But he's just shutting things down left and right at every turn. And he has no open conversation loops is what you're saying, where he's not giving you anything else. You ask a question, a very open-ended question with a nice cold read. And he just gives you, I'm the uncle with hip hop.
Yeah.
And it's then where do you go? Like, so this is very difficult, but I don't think it has anything to do with you and him or the rapport. It's just, I just don't think he likes to interview. I'd have to go listen to more interviews that he's on.
Yeah. So my technique here was I'm kind of timescaping so it seems like we're covering a lot of stuff. Like I'm going from SpongeBob SquarePants in the 2010s all the way back to the 1980s. And we're covering like a vast, you know, span of time, so it feels like we're bonding over different things, but it's still difficult.
Well, it's a very smart interview technique, because what you're trying to do is you're trying to find a hot button. You're trying to find something he's passionate about that he'll actually talk about. So you're being forced to time jump around a lot, and you just haven't found that thing yet.
There a little bit. You'll see in a second. Interesting stuff in a second. So did you write that song? How did you put that song together?
I just thought of, it was supposed to be a serious song. I was trying to do a type of song like I Need Love by LL.
Yeah.
And I just wrote the song out because it occurred to me. So instead of fighting somebody, I just wrote it out.
Instead of fighting with somebody?
I wrote the song out.
And were you in a relationship at the time?
I put the pain on the pen and paper.
He's talking about just a friend. Is that because you were going out with somebody and
that happened?
Oh, that's horrible. How did you get over that? Like, so other than writing the song, did you end up in a relationship that was good?
Oh yeah. I just know that I don't trust a girl that says she just got a friend.
All right, that's good advice. So what are you up to now? What are you working on these days?
I'm just DJing and I'm doing Yo Gabba Gabba. We may be in our eighth season.
Your eighth season. So this is one of the longest running cable shows ever.
Seemed like it, because it's a kid show. It's all Nick Jr.
And do you go on tour at all? Do you perform?
Yeah, well, I'm on a massive ceremony tour, and I'm having my own tour coming up.
When's your tour start?
One tour starts in July. I think one tour starts in August.
And in 2010, you and Jeff Goldblum performed Just a Friend on Jimmy Fallon.
Oh, that was 2010. I thought that was 2012.
No, 2010. See, time goes fast at our age.
Time goes fast.
Yeah. I'm gonna out you here, but you just turned 50 years old.
Yes, I am, and I'm proud of it.
I feel like I was a kid when I listened to Just a Friend, and I'm going to turn 50 soon.
Oh, it is what it is.
So
good music lasts.
Yeah, good music does last. So do you ever get tired, though, of people just talking about Just a Friend? Like, you've done so many things in your career.
I'm tired
you've
been of you talking so about the
starter of this conversation. Everyone gets, including me, everyone gets back to Just a Friend.
I out myself.
You did.
I mean, they talk about everything.
But they that's the one, even on your website.
Big Daddy Kane out. They talk about a lot of stuff. And they just a Friend is just my swan song.
Right. Also, I have to say, the YouTube video of DJ Kool doing Let Me Clear My Throat with your appearance on that, that's
there
a great video.
Oh, it's all right. We did it in Philly at a club called Gotham.
Is that club still around?
Nah.
So what's like the funnest thing you've done in the past? You've done everything, so I don't even know where to begin.
There's so many things that was fun. I can't even tell you.
Like, what are some of the things that I haven't even mentioned? Celebrity Fit Club, Men in Black, Nick Jr., Just a Friend. You've done everything. I want your career.
You can have it. Take it.
No, I got to work too hard. 6 to 10 hours. That's too much work. Yeah. When did you start seeing like the results of working that hard? Like, how many hours do you think you had put in altogether before you would say you were a good rapper?
I can't tell you. I just know that I was rocking parties and getting paid for it. Once I started getting money for it, then I knew that it was good.
And when did that happen?
I started getting money in 83, 82.
And was it like enough money to live on? Like, were you really, you know, able to live large then? Were you getting by?
In 86 is when it started, when I got money that I had to live on.
Okay, stop there. And so he started practicing 6 to 10 hours a day in 1977, and it wasn't until 1986 that he can make a living.
9 years.
9 years of 6 to 10 hours a day of practice. And I believe him that he was doing that every day because he loved it. He clearly wasn't doing anything else. So
it's hard work no matter what you do, man. It's like an overnight success, which I consider just a friend still. An overnight success takes a long, long time and a lot of practice.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, overnight success, like just a friend, you know, it was an accident, first of all, right? The way that it kind of came out, turned into this kind of parody song. And, yeah. You know, at least the video was. And then, but, you know, he had prepared to get himself to that point. So all of those tens of thousands of hours of practicing had paid off when he did Just a Friend, but it wasn't like he just created a YouTube video and then threw it up there. Of course, YouTube didn't even exist back then, but you know what I'm saying? Like he had to pave the way.
You know, even take like a guy like Macklemore, though, who put up the YouTube video of Thrift Shop and then suddenly got half a billion views. That guy, you know, and he's still a young guy, but he had been rapping and performing for something like 10 years mm-hmm. with no recognition at all. And finally he got big from Thrift Shop and the YouTube video. That was really the start. Nobody knew who he was before then. And then every record label called him, of course, and he said no to every record label because you don't need them. Like, he had a half a billion views on YouTube. He was going to start selling on iTunes no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, let's I thought that was the most interesting part of the interview with Biz Markie. I mean, there's some other stuff, but the fact that he worked so hard and for so long doing what he loved, but I always think love plus persistence equals abundance, and it worked out for him. But then he talks about the abundance part next. How did you hold on to it? Like, I know for myself, when I first made money, I basically spent it all and went broke. I had to make money several times before I stopped going broke. How did you learn to kind of hold on to your money?
Really, my habits is like buying stuff off eBay or buying records. So that ain't really a crazy expensive habit if you bought it. You know what I mean?
Right. So you didn't like go out and buy like a helicopter or a huge mansion or anything like that?
I'm a car freak, but you know, at the time I was making so much money, it didn't even make no sense. You know what I mean? So it didn't really hurt my stuff.
Like, what do you mean so much money? Are we talking like $50 million or $5 million? Like, what was a lot of money back then on a good album?
I can't tell you how much, but I just know I made a lot of money.
And so you wouldn't buy houses. You would go out and buy cars.
I mean, I invest my money right. I just can't tell you how I did it.
And did you invest at all?
Yeah, I invested. I can't tell you what I invest in, but I invest.
Okay, good.
I invest in property. I invest in coins. I invest in gold.
And you still invest in gold?
I got enough. I'm good.
All right, good. Because gold's had quite a run since like 1989. You've done well with it.
Oh yeah, because gold. But I bought a lot of gold in the 90s. So right now, gold is worth a lot.
Why did you pick gold?
Because gold never goes down.
I mean, sometimes it goes down. Like from 1980 to 1990, it went down.
Yeah, but that, I'm talking about now.
Right.
Now is different.
Okay, stop for a second. He's right. Like, so he didn't buy when it was going down, and he's probably made a lot on it since
then. I mean, he's pretty matter of fact, right? He's very much...
he's not an investment expert, so...
No, and I don't really know why. I think he may have had some friend that said, hey, man, gold's where you need to be or whatever. I mean, I like gold. Look, I own some gold. I do it as more of a catastrophe insurance in case things go bad, which I know we're not going to talk about that because then you're like, well, it's never going to go bad. Fine, whatever.
No, you know what? I own silver.
Okay, yeah, so same thing. Gold and silver are real money. You know, that's, you know, the gold standard, all that stuff. So somebody probably did tell him that at some point. You know what I'm proud of when hearing the interview is whoever told him to get into gold, he got in at a great price. But the great thing about gold is gold can be sold at any time and will always have some kind of a market for it. You know, I don't know what price. As opposed to most of these superstars, they get really bad advice and then they open a bunch of restaurants or, you know, software or whatever, like Kurt Schilling, you know, $600 million. He at least, somebody gave him sound advice somewhere for investing, it sounds like. Because at least gold, yeah, you got to store it, it's physical and all that stuff, but you can get rid of it if you need to for cash.
Yeah, it's true. And look, it's a good thing to have in the portfolio. I don't know. I wouldn't have, me personally, I'm not as much of a gold guy as like many people. I don't think it's a hedge against inflation if you kind of correlate it with inflation. But I like silver because it's both a precious metal and an industrial metal, yeah, as opposed to gold, which is just a precious metal.
I agree.
But Bismarcky agrees with you.
But he's
on the gold,
but man, so. He's giving you, I mean, he's not giving you anything, James. This is still like pulling teeth. This is tough. You're doing,
I mean, I'm learning on each level, but I kind of have to pull it out.
I mean, you're a pro here. See, for me, I bet you I would have bailed long ago because I would just feel like I was wasting his time, but you're doing a good job of still navigating. So for the podcast, do you have all your notes in front of you? Because you're doing a lot of quick hits in time, throwing out a bunch of names, throwing out a bunch of different things that he's done.
I mean, I prepared a lot for it. Like, I watched, you know, Yo Gabba Gabba, SpongeBob SquarePants. I watched all his videos. I watched the Jeff Goldblum appearance with the Roots. I watched everything. You know, but, you know, I couldn't, it's not like I'm going to ask about each detail of everything. I'm just trying to, what I really got out of it was how hard he had to work. And, you know, also he talks a little bit about mastery in a little bit. So that's interesting. So let's roll it.
All right.
What do you get like nervous about?
I don't get nervous about nothing. Only thing I get nervous about is going on a plane that I can't fly myself.
So you like to be in control?
Yes.
Maybe that's why you wanted a solo career, because then you knew you could be in control of what you were doing.
Yeah.
Did you ever have a problem because you weren't always in control of all the publishing rights or anything like that?
No, I'm not worried about that. I got all my stuff.
Oh, stop there, actually. It's a very important thing. So he actually did get sued for doing a sample once in 1991, and that's really when he stopped doing records on his own.
Mm, okay.
So and, you know, and actually it was a mistake for me to bring that up about the publishing rights, like, because I kind of knew in advance he didn't really want to.
It was an off-limit topic.
Well, it wasn't necessarily off-limits, like I'm bringing it up now, but I just knew he had nothing to say about that. But
gotcha.
I forgot. Okay.
Yes.
Well, who are your favorite, over the past, like, 30 years, who are your favorite rappers right now?
I like a lot of them. I can't tell you who. It's too many to name.
You don't want to leave anyone out?
Nope.
You might insult them.
Nope.
Well, this is great. So thanks so much for coming on my podcast. You've had an incredible career. Can I ask you one question? So in Just a Friend, there's this one scene, brilliant scene. You're playing the piano, you're dressed like Mozart, and you're singing the old Freddie Scott song a little bit out of tune. What were you thinking of creatively? Like, I know you're just having fun, but what were some of the ideas going through your head?
I just wanted to be an old school type of Mozart, George Washington is singing the record. I wanted it to be just something that would be so different that people were able to jump out the screen.
And even the out-of-tune part, like you singing out-of-tune, strangely sounded in tune on the song. Because rap was playing with that whole idea of distorting music. And I really like the out-of-tune choice. But what were you thinking?
I just wanted to ask people to sing it for me, and they wouldn't sing it, so I had to sing it myself.
I see. And were you feeling like you weren't much of a singer? You were more of a rapper?
Nope. I felt like I've sung it right.
Okay, good. So, I want to, again, thank you so much for coming on.
So awkward.
My podcast. You've really taken a career that started out in one direction, rap, and it's almost like shattered into 20 other careers. You've really been really great at reinventing yourself. What advice would you give someone who wants to switch from one career to another career, someone who wants to reinvent themselves?
You got to master one at a time.
And how do you master something?
If you do multiple careers, you got to master one at a time. You can't do all of them at the same time, because if you don't master one, you got to master one, then go to the next, master it. So even if you have to go back to that career, you already know what you're doing.
And how do you master something?
I thought that was great advice.
I can't explain. I agree. I just know how to do it myself.
Like for you, it sounds like you put in the time, you put in the hours, but did you have like, in each case, did you have teachers or you just kind of like naturally, you know, felt your way through it?
No, I did it myself.
Like with rap, you must have been influenced by like Afrika Bambaataa.
I listened to Cold Crush, Master Rob, Busy Bee Star. I listened to them, but I still had to make my own style.
And at the time, I would say the first real breakout rap hit was Run DMC. And at the time,
Rapper's Delight.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Rapper's Delight, Sugar Hill Gang.
You got Rapper's Delight. You got The Breaks. You got a lot of records that broke out first. It's because they wasn't mainstream. That don't mean they didn't break out. You got Spoonie G. You got The Treacherous Three. A lot of them records was the blueprint on how to make a record.
What do you mean by blueprint?
The blueprint, like everybody that writes Fast Rhymes today had to listen to a Treacherous Three. They were the first one.
Right.
You had to listen to Rapper's Delight first to how to make a record. Run DMC came at a good time. They put rock and stuff with it, but it was after these guys did it first.
Right. Just stop right there for a second. It's a really great point, actually, that to master something, you kind of have to build on all of the building blocks that happened before then.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what he's kind of underlining for me there.
I think it's a valuable point.
Yeah. So, you know, it's why people who want to know how to invest, for instance, I always tell them read. So I like to read investment books, even written like in the early 1900s, you know, or study the bubbles and stuff from the 1800s, 1700s and so on. Like really learn the history of everything you're doing. It's really critical. Well, read the letters Warren Buffett wrote even before his Berkshire letters. Like his Berkshire letters are open to the public, but not his earlier letters. Like track those down and read them. So anyway, that's Biz Markie's equivalent is all of these other rappers from before Run DMC, who really was the first mainstream breakout.
Mm-hmm.
At Harlem World and all these places, listen to them first. They didn't just come out of the ground.
Right. And they had, they of course also had Russell Simmons really pushing them as well.
Russell Simmons used to be a promoter.
But
then he turned into manager and doing all that. But Run DMC was rappers from around Queens.
Did you ever have a chance to work with them?
Yeah, I mean, I used to rock with them sometimes. JMSJ was my man, you know what I mean?
Ah, yeah. So let me ask you this. Jay-Z, I saw in one interview where you said you knew Jay-Z as a little kid.
Yes, I knew Jay-Z since 81, 82, when he used to be in a group with my man Chase and a Jazzo. There used to be three people in the group.
And were you able to tell that this guy was going to be really stand out?
Just like watch him. He always was great. It's just that he needed his music to catch up to his rap. Once his music caught up to him, once he had the beats to catch up to his rap, he was out of here. That's all he needed.
So he had the rap skill, but you're saying
always
maybe the melody
the
wasn't
skill.
There, or what do you mean by having
the
music
catch
up to rap?
No, I'm talking about the beats. His music wasn't it.
I don't think I understand. So there
like
wasn't
if
a good
whoever
producer?
Whoever was making his beat, it wasn't coinciding. Like, if you ever hear any of my records go with my beats. My raps go with my beats.
Ah, I see. So he would be rapping, and it wouldn't necessarily be going along with the music.
No. The person didn't make the record right for it.
Ah, I
it's
see.
It's just that his music had to match him. If you listen to Jay-Z on any of his records now, the music matches him.
And do you think that also, like, in the starting around in the late 80s, 90s, suddenly you have all these producers who really knew how to make rap. They weren't rappers, but they knew how to make rap records. So suddenly you
had but the thing is just that certain people mesh with different people.
Right. And so...
So when he came out in, like, 95 and 96, when he, after he started hanging with Big Daddy Kane and hanging with Biggie and know how to make a record. Once he found the formula, he was out of here. Nobody taught him nothing. He just learned the formula.
And what do you think makes a great rapper right now?
I don't know, because it's different these days.
Like, what makes it different?
It's just different. I'm older, so I can't speak on how these dudes do their stuff now.
Take a guy like Eminem, for instance.
You can't put Eminem with these new guys, because Eminem really knows how to rap, and he knows how to battle, and he had a taste of, he just knows what he's doing.
And were, you know, back in the 80s or 70s, were you also doing battles or?
Yeah,
you know,
I always battle. I battle to this day.
Really, to this day?
Yeah.
So I won't challenge you unless I practice really hard.
We go all day, whatever you want to go on with. I don't care if it's pogo sticking. We're going to battle.
Okay, we could play chess maybe.
All right. I got to see you. I got to go now. I'll call you later.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, So that's it.
Yeah, you weren't really enjoying the very end of that, were you?
No, I mean, I was really feeling uncomfortable the whole time. But, you know, he had a lot of valuable stuff. Like, you know, it's one of the best guys in an entire multi-billion dollar industry. So there's always something to learn, you know, and I learned a lot from it. But I just felt personally uncomfortable during the interview.
Well, he had a lot of very valuable lessons. You know, he probably bailed at the very end. Probably because was up against the clock or something, but also because you did give him that, like, okay, thanks for coming on, and then you ask him 10 more minutes of questions that he didn't want to talk about. So he probably felt like, I thought this dude was going to hang up, and now here I am, just getting a barrage of questions again.
Right, so it ended up being, like, listening to it now, it ended up being a much better interview than I thought it was. It was just I felt personally uncomfortable.
Yeah, I get that, and I'm sure Claudia will be very happy to hear that you've healed from your wounds, because you were this thing was like OCD in your head for a couple of weeks after you did this.
Yeah.
Like, to the point where she was like, James, I swear if you bring up Bismarcky again, I'm going to strangle you.
Well, I couldn't stop playing the Just a Friend and the DJ Kool song, Let Me Clear My Throat. Like, I was just psycho playing it. And she was like, I think blood was coming out of her ears in the other room. Like, I was playing it so much.
Overall, James, thought it was a great interview. I think you prepared fantastically for this, as you always do. You know, one of the lessons is, you know, you got to be very objective when it comes to a craft. And when it comes to interviewing people, it's a difficult job, because it's like, I always kind of give the analogy with going up and talking to girls in bars or bookstores or whatever the case is. All I know is my perspective, right? So if I go up and say, hey, you're cute, I wanted to introduce myself, my name's Aaron, blah, blah, blah. She could have just had a death in the family. She could have, like, been fired from her job that day. Like, you never know the other intangibles, yeah. Right? See, we don't know the intangibles of what was going on with his life. We don't know if he was forced to do the podcast by his publicist or what the case was. So I think for you, my advice to you, and I don't think it's even a problem with you, is, you know, you just can't take these things personal. I know he was like an idol to you, and you really wanted to be boys like you are with Ice-T now, but sometimes you just can't make that happen, right? I mean, you did a great job overall. You threw out tons of conversation threads. You objectively went back and picked out what you believe are the best parts of this. So I think overall, successful A-.
Well, thank you very much. And, you know, I know I'm not sure when this podcast is coming out, but the one that's up currently right now is Jim Norton, The Art of Comedy.
Yes.
Jim Norton,
listen to it.
Have you listened to that one?
I did.
So that was an interesting one for me, because we didn't laugh at all during the interview. Like, it was very different from other podcasts he normally does, where he does his act on the podcast. But I loved it because we talked about really almost like the science of comedy and how, and it was fun also because I grew up with him.
I think that's why you got a very real interview out of him, because he didn't feel the need to be funny. He could actually take his comic mask off, because you guys did go to elementary school together. You know, he knew you as this chess champion guy who claimed he could beat Bobby Fischer with just being spotted one rook.
Yeah.
And you knew him as the guy who came into your school and just killed it, like the first day even. So that's the thing too, right? So the familiarity will change the dynamics of an interview. Which was cool.
And
so I really enjoyed that because I got to see the real side of him. I think he gave away a lot of things about himself that were personal that he probably doesn't reveal to other people because he doesn't have that comfort level.
Yeah, Claudia was very unsure about it beforehand. And she listened to it and was blown away. She was like, wow, this is what the Jim Norton I wanted to hear. So I was pleased with that one. And, you know, with most of the podcasts, I actually do know the people. But just this with Biz Markie and some of the other ones we have, but Biz Markie in particular, I just couldn't figure out how to connect. But still, we got some good stuff out of it. So Aaron, thanks for helping me analyze this one. And I hope people enjoyed how we did this. And I'll see you when I see you.
All right, man, I'll talk to you on today's Ask Altucher.
Yes.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.